always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
404 on this Wednesday edition of the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. We got a lot to talk about today. We have our usual guest on with us, including my partner, Tim Jones, who will be with us shortly at 424. We'll speak with Zach Smith. He is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 blog. And because this is election season and it's April, we'll have school board's candidate, Francis Howe school board candidate, Adriana Kuhn and Sam Young in studio with us at 524. Tim, I was just letting everyone know that it's our usual Wednesday guest, but we've got school board guests in at 524 in studio with us.
Those elections, Chris, are next Tuesday. Going to come up really fast because we've got the Easter weekend, of course, which will distract a lot of us with family and friends and remembering the reason for the season, as it is for all of us Christians. It is a High Holy Week this week we're in the middle of. The Easter Triduum, as they call it, begins tomorrow with Maundy Thursday. That's the old term for Holy Thursday, and then Good Friday. The Easter Vigil's on Saturday. Easter Sunday, we'll have Easter Monday, and then Election Tuesday. So Chris will talk to some of those candidates, all important school board races, right, Chris? Because people are still, you know, fired up as they should be with everything we learned that was really going on in public schools, especially K through 12 during the COVID years.
You know, one thing that I learned when I worked at the election board in the early 2000s was some of the most contentious races were won for the mayoralship or aldermanic board for some of these little municipalities or villages, and school board elections. People took those elections very, very seriously because, you know, you're talking about your property taxes being raised, and some senior citizens don't have children within the school system, so they don't necessarily appreciate having their property taxes raised to pay for education that some would say is substandard. And so those were the issues back in the day. But as you said, the issues of today are what are the teachers and the school districts teaching our children? And we got a good glimpse into that during the pandemic.
I was reminded today of a great resource for local elections, courtesy of some ladies that are, some of them are based here in our listening region. Some are scattered across the state. They call themselves the MOPP Ladies, M-O-P-P. It stands for Missouri Precinct Project, and they sent out a ton of recommendations for local elections next week. We won't have the time to go through all of them. We'll go through some of them throughout the next week or so, but if anybody would like this resource, it's a great resource. They send out a lot of information on other things that are occurring across the state, so all you need to do is, and we'll put this, Joey, maybe we could put this in the Facebook chat and on Twitter. So all you need to do is send an email to spell it all out, MissouriPrecinctProject@gmail.com. Just send an email, MissouriPrecinctProject@gmail.com. Just say that Tim Jones and Chris Arp sent you and you would like to be added to their email list. Chris, it's ladies like Judy Safka and Frida Keogh and Kate Sickles. Yeah, so they, what they do is they're kind of like an amalgamator. It's like you send your event or you send your recommendations or you send your update to them, and they kind of put a bunch of stuff together and they send out a big giant email every 2 to 3 weeks or so. It's like a bullet. It's basically a center right conservative bulletin board of all the things going on that you need to know. And so one of the things they sent out today was school board candidate recommendations. I was like, how timely. Thank you very much to the MOPP ladies. Thanks to Judy and Frida and Kate and all the other ladies that work on this. They've been doing this for well over a decade. MissouriPrecinctProject@gmail.com. Just send them an email. They'll put you on their list.
And I remember also one of their issues that they started out working on was getting rid of these voting machines and hand counting ballots. That was a big initiative that they worked hard on. So good to see them giving everyone a guide to some of these school board elections, because it's like the judges sometimes when you go in there to vote, you feel like you're going in there voting blind.
Yeah, you know, back when I was a practicing lawyer, which some of my friends are snickering right now, and they're like, when were you ever a practicing lawyer? Well, I did for nearly two decades. You know, I'm in my second half of my career life here. I knew all the judges. I knew them well. I could cite you to the good, the bad, and the ugly. But Chris, I haven't practiced law in 9 years. And so some of them are still on the bench that I knew. I've helped some folks get on the bench, but honestly, I don't know that. And so we're like anybody else. You know, if people have put together a recommendation list for judges or local school boards or county or city elections, you can send it to the MOP ladies and they'll send it to all of us. So MissouriPrecinctProject@gmail.com. Yeah, they lobbied me really hard when I was in the legislature for the paper ballot stuff. And man, they worked on that for over a decade and they got it done. You know, persistence pays off. Persistence and patience.
It does. So, and again, 524 Francis House School Board candidates Adriana Kuhn and Sam Young. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. They will be in studio with us at 524.
That's fantastic. Chris, we had that huge, you talked about it yesterday. We had the Mipha Prestone case yesterday before the Supreme Court.
Say that three times quickly.
No more times right now. I have to prepare myself to say that word and then just spit it right out. So I know we'll talk to Zach Smith about that case and a ton of other Supreme Court decisions that are where we're waiting to be handed down. So let's see. We flip the calendar next week. Next Monday will be April 1st, no fooling, and we'll have just a few months left in the Supreme Court term. So all these cases we've been talking about, the Chevron deference cases, the Mipha Prestone case, there's some other religious freedom and liberty cases, the Missouri versus Murthy case that we were cited, our station was cited in Andrew Bailey's court brief as one of the many radio stations that was suppressed by YouTube and censored. All of those cases, the hand downs, they're called judicial hand downs, they'll start happening. And so we got a lot to talk with Zach about at 425.
You know, speaking of abortion, yesterday was election day still around the country, election in Alabama. And I don't know how much is it a harbinger of what's to come in the coming election. I think it could be. The Democrats flipped a Republican seat in the state house in Alabama. And the main campaign issue the Democrat was running on was IVF. So I don't know if that's an oddity, if something that happened, or is that the harbinger of the future to come later in November? I don't know. What do you think, Tim?
You know, I saw the headline on that. Excuse me. I'm choking on coffee. I saw the headline on that. I do not know the details. I don't know if there was something weird about this special election. It's a reminder, though, that of something we said yesterday. We will not be using words red wave or blowout or any of that. Everybody this year in a presidential election year is going to have to fight for every single seat, from city council seats to state rep seats to state senate seats, all the way up to the presidency. If you want common sense center right candidates who are going to protect things that are enshrined in the Constitution and to protect life and your Second Amendment rights and keep your taxes low, you're going to have to work hard for every seat. You can't just presume just because it feels like something's going the right way that it's going to happen. Every seat will have to be protected this year.
You know, and Donald Trump got a gift yesterday, and it wasn't his court cases being kicked out or having his judgment reduced. I lost my train of thought. I forgot what it was. Something that happened to him yesterday. It'll come back to me.
He got the bail reduced. Did we talk about that already?
Yeah, it was something totally
not the bail,
outside.
The judgment.
It was something totally outside of that.
Okay, we'll have to look that up. Maybe Zach might know. Another headline I saw today. You probably saw this as well. The congressional exodus continues. One of the prominent centrist House Democrats announced her retirement. One of the ladies, one of the congresswomen from New Hampshire. And get this, Chris, that makes the 46th member of Congress. More than 10% of Congress is retiring this year. And this is interesting. the more Democrats are retiring than Republicans. It's close. 25 House Democrats have announced their retirement. 21 Republicans have announced their retirement. I guess this is a good time to get the heck out of Washington, D.C. or something. Everybody's headed for the doors.
I mean, everyone that's saying that are leaving, Ken Buck said it last week. He said that the House is dysfunctional, that it wasn't worth it for him to be up there. The people there, he believed, didn't want to get things done. So he's leaving in the middle of his term instead of ending his term, which I think is kind of lame. You know, you made a commitment to the people, at least finish your term. You know, some of these people that are retiring have made, I don't know, I hope they're joking remarks. They're saying there are more Republicans that are looking to retire early, which could, you know, give Hakeem Jeffries the speaker's gavel and make him
which
speaker.
Is insane.
I don't know if people would do that, but there's a lot of people say butthurt feelings there in the Congress. And, I could see some people spiting, the leadership, spiting the party, to do that. One member who's leaving early, I think it was Ken Buck. There is a discharge petition, two of them, to get Ukraine aid on the House floor. He is leaving. His last day was last week. He signed both of those discharge petitions before he left out. And because his seat will still be open until November, his signature will count on any discharge petition, getting the necessary 290, I think it is.
The congresswoman who's retiring, her name is Annie Kuster with a K, and she is from New Hampshire. And she is known as a top centrist House Democrat. Not a household name, but apparently she's very well known inside the Beltway. She's retiring after 12 years in Congress. So these are people that have made careers. On the other hand, you know what? I'm okay with folks after they've served a decade or more in Congress going back home, because that's originally how Congress was set up. It was supposed to be a citizen legislature. And it's nice to see that people, they do their public service, they do their time, and then they go back home.
But I don't want people going home saying the place is dysfunctional and I don't want to be here and people don't want to get things done. I want them to go home and say, you know, I've accomplished some things, I passed some stuff, now it's time to pass the torch, I'm going home. People are going home because they're saying that's their words, not mine, is that the place is dysfunctional.
When was the last time someone called Congress functional, I guess is my question. Maybe we go back to the Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton era, you know, when we had divided government that seemed to work.
I think dysfunctional is having now, with Marjorie Taylor Greene doing what she did, having three calls for a new speaker within a year and a half. I think that's the definition of dysfunctional.
It would be nice if Republicans would circle the wagons every once in a while, like the Democrats do. You know, one thing about the Democrats, I don't like any of their policies or procedures, but, you know, it seems like they have most of their battles behind closed doors. I'm sure they have. I'm sure you look at the Democratic Party and the current Democratic Party, and it has arguably been taken over on the base level by left wing progressives. But there's still plenty of people that you would consider moderate Democrats. So I'm sure that moderate Democrats from the Midwest have huge disagreements with people like AOC from New York City. But they seem to keep most of those disagreements behind closed doors. And it'd be nice if the Republicans could have those knockdown dragouts behind closed doors and then come out with a united front, because you need to govern once you're elected, or the American people will go, you know, I'm not sure whose policies are better or not. Probably the Republicans, but they can't govern. And so, yeah, in these 435 congressional races that happen every 2 years, just about anything can happen. And you want to have a united front with a platform.
Yeah, that's been my cry the last few weeks, is that if you don't have a cohesiveness and you're not together, you're probably going to lose these elections.
And it's one of the reasons why Newt Gingrich was so successful. He appeared at the time in the 90s to have on the surface level, to outsiders looking in, to be organized, right? He had the contract with America. He said, these are the things that we will do if elected. And, you know, if you tell the American people, here's who we are, here's what we stand for, and here's what we do, then they can go, okay, I know what I'm voting for now. But if you're just all over the place and you can't even support your leadership team on any given day, then people go, I don't know what that Party stands for. I don't know what they're going to do, and I don't know why I should vote for them.
You know, I've heard it described perfectly on the podcast the other day, and I wish I could take credit for it, but this person was saying one of the criticisms that they had for what they're calling, quote-unquote, the far-right faction in the House, U.S. House of Representatives, is they haven't defined what is victory. What is to the point where, yes, but we'll accept that. That's good. We feel like we can go back to our members, go back to our constituents and say, this is the first part of the battle we've won, but we've got many more battles to win. And I think that's a good description of it. It's like, what is victory? And to believe in a completely divided government where now you have a one seat majority, to think that you can get everything that you want 100%, that's not a realistic victory.
One of the things they could do is go back to basics, because see, the left is redefining Republicanism, and the Republicans shouldn't let them do that. The left is now redefining someone like Ronna McDaniel, who's a pretty moderate, milquetoast, middle of the road person, as a MAGA extremist. And so I would go back to basics, and I would say, under Reagan believed in smaller, limited government. Cut taxes, keep regulations low, protect your constitutional rights, freedoms, and liberties, protect the Second Amendment, and let people have educational choice. Go back to the basics. And if the left wants to call that extremist, let them, because it's basic Republican Party platform principles. And that's what I think you need a new contract with America, basically, to define that for the folks. Amy Mazzara remembered what you were trying to remember, Chris. Truth Social went public yesterday.
I think it was that.
That was her suggestion.
That may have been it. Thank you, Amy.
Mm-hmm. That was her
suggestion. I think that was it. But it's. I think that's it. It's about 50-50. It'll come to me. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Amy, for chiming in on our Facebook feed along with Scotty and Charles and others. You can also follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Rumble, rumble.com. Joey, can you follow us on YouTube, or what's going on there?
You know, I'd rather not mess with the YouTube.
Not even talk about it.
I don't want to anger them.
Yeah, we don't want to mess with that. So there you go. You got Twitter, X, you got Facebook, you got Rumble. And you can also call us as well, 314-912-1019.
And we do like calls. Give us a call. We love hearing your voice, letting you know that Tim and I aren't just speaking to Joey, and there's actually other people out there listening to us.
We know we have a very busy, and it feels often like a short show. 2 hours goes by really fast, and we know you are all hanging on the edges of your seat waiting for Chris's corner or the stump speech or one of our guests, and we know we roll through that quickly. But like this, you know, the top segments, like the 405 or the 505, those are good times to call us during those segments. Or the 445 or the 545, you can give us a call after Chris wraps up the stumps, wraps up Chris's corner. He likes to hear, you know, what y'all thought about that. And you can call us at 545 when we're just generally kind of wrapping up the show. So, you know, the guest segments, it's tough to take calls during the guest segments, which are always at 425 and 525. But, you know, the other ones, you know, hey, a worst case scenario, you get to talk to producer Joey for a few minutes.
Joey does not fight.
Yeah.
Hey, keep it shorter. I don't want to hear your life story. Be ready.
That's right. All right, Chris. Well, we got a busy show, so we better get to it. As Chris mentioned, we got Zach Smith, Legal Fault, the Heritage Foundation coming up. Talk about Trump Lawfare. We'll talk about True Social going public. We'll talk about these SCOTUS decisions that are coming down the pike. And Chris's Corner, 445, Speaker Stump Speech at 507, and the Francis Howell School Board candidates in studio at 525. All that straight ahead. Happy hump day, all y'all. Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, 101.9, 94.1, Newstalk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Trump legal spokeswoman Alina Haba Aliba, what happened today?
We won. No, we didn't win. You know when we'll win? When we get this all reversed, which is what's going to happen. So what happened today was that Letitia had to eat every single tweet she has posted since the day the twisted order from Judge Ngoren came out, with the ridiculous number, with the disgusting injustice on the American people, not just Donald Trump. And I am so proud of the appellate division for giving us the opportunity. They didn't reverse the case, but they will when they see what we saw.
429 on the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show. And Tim, it's Wednesday, and you know what that means.
Mm-hmm, I sure do.
Oh, it's all perfectly legal.
You are out of order. You're out of order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order.
Zach. Jack Smith, legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation.
You know, I ask you a lot of predictions. Can you predict what the Supreme Court probably will do with this action? Zach, welcome into the Tim Jones and Chris Zarb show. You heard that clip there of Trump lawyer Alina Haba talking about the reduced amount of money that Donald Trump will have to put up as a bond. We read today that the judge in the case has placed him under a gag order. I want to ask you about that. But second, Donald Trump is the former president of the United States. Is there a judge on this planet in the United States that has the cojones to put him in jail for contempt of court?
Well, first you have to ask your question whether or not he has actually committed contempt of court. Obviously, you know, he comments a lot on the judges, their judicial staff. And, you know, what's interesting about this, Chris, is generally in the United States, we strongly disfavor something known as a prior restraint. We don't prohibit people from speaking their minds, putting their views out into the marketplace of ideas. We tend to deal with it on the back end. For instance, if they defame someone or if they threaten someone, they can either be held criminally or civilly accountable. And so it's been very interesting. You know, it's been a fine line that judges walk with any criminal defendant about whether or not to issue a gag order to prohibit someone from speaking, because there are very real First Amendment concerns whenever those types of orders are entered. But that's even more so when the defendant happens to also be a former president and one of the leading contenders to be president once again.
Zach, would you please explain to our audience, for the non-lawyers and for those who can't stand lawyers, what it means to what it means to put up a bond in a case like Donald Trump was being required to do, and the fact that the bond was reduced? I guess hope springs eternal, Zach. Even in the once mighty former great state of New York, you had the appeals division, the appellate courts, reduce that bond dramatically. And Zach, I don't know if they wrote an order in that case or not, but I would imagine the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution was in their minds, because Zach, we abolished debtors' prisons a long time ago. Yes, we want to hold people to account, but in a civil case, you're not supposed to punish someone to the point where it's an Eighth Amendment violation for an unreasonable punishment via a monetary judgment or a bond or anything. So could you explain the whole, you know, why do you put up a bond, and what did you think about the decision to reduce the bond?
Yeah, absolutely. And Tim, I'm shocked that people can't stand lawyers. Who wouldn't love to spend a day in a room full of lawyers? I can't imagine that. But look, this is a great question. I think it's important to, at the outset here, to distinguish between a bond in a criminal case and a bond in a civil case. You know, a criminal case, when we're talking about a bond, essentially it's something someone pays, or maybe a surety, a company comes in and says, we'll guarantee this person's appearance, or will pay this amount of money to the court if they don't show up. It's what we typically think of as bail bondsmen, right? If someone doesn't show up for court, the bail bondsman has agreed to ensure their appearance, or they'll pay a certain amount of money. That's bond in the criminal context. In the civil context, in this case, it's a little bit different. What's happened with Donald Trump, and it was with any civil defendant, is they've been sued. A judgment against Donald Trump has been entered. And essentially what the court wants to make sure is that while he appeals that decision, if he ultimately loses that appeal, there'll be money left over to pay the judgment. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure that a defendant won't, you know, spend all of their resources trying to hide money, that sort of thing. They want to make sure that if the judgment stands, there's money to pay the plaintiff. And so that's what the bond is in this case. And then as to your point about the amount of bond, look, given the absolutely astronomical judgment that was entered against Donald Trump, the amount the court originally was requiring to put up for bond was itself astronomical. And I've heard some attorneys, some representing Donald Trump, some legal commentators, raise the same concerns that you raised, Tim, is that, you know, we have a clause in the Constitution, a clause in the Eighth Amendment, that not only prohibits cruel and unusual punishments, but that also prohibits excessive fines or excessive fees and that sort of thing. And so I think that certainly was at the forefront of many people's minds as they're looking at this astronomical amount of money that Donald Trump was going to be required to put up in order to appeal his case and not have his property seized in the process.
Speaking with Zach Smith, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast. Zach, on Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case dealing with mifepristone, whether the FDA approved it in the correct way. It seemed that the justices, even the conservative ones, seemed to be skeptical of the arguments. One of the concerns seemed to be, did the plaintiffs have standing? And some of the examples that the plaintiffs gave regarding mifepristone affecting women. And it had never happened before, but they were just kind of just scenarios, and that had justices skeptical. Can you tell us more, sir?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to tell you, Chris, you're sounding an awful lot like a lawyer over there talking about standing, whether this was a proper party to bring the case.
I listen to SCOTUS 101 podcast, everybody.
There you go.
All right. Well, good deal. Well, look, you've hit the nail on the head. And really, when we talk about this particular case at the court, it's important to separate the underlying substantive issues from the standing issue that the court spent so much time on during oral argument. And as you mentioned, Chris, standing is essentially whether or not the individuals bringing this lawsuit have the legal ability to do so, whether they're the proper parties to bring this suit. And it's fair to say the court's current standing doctrine about who can bring suit in what instances is an absolute mess. And it's a mess largely because over the past several decades, the court has expanded standing in an effort to cater to pet liberal causes. We've seen this often in environmental cases where the court has drastically liberalized their standing rules in order to allow actions against the EPA and others to go forward. And so it's created a mess in terms of standing doctrine. And so a lot of the argument at the oral arguments earlier this week focused on the court's current standing doctrine, whether these particular plaintiffs, particularly the Association of Doctors that were one of the groups bringing this lawsuit, challenging the FDA's approval of this abortion-inducing drug, whether they in fact had standing. And, you know, it's really interesting because Justice Alito in particular raised the concern repeatedly that if no one has standing, the legal ability to bring these types of suits, it would essentially mean that the government could act illegally with little or no direct recourse in terms of litigation. And so that was an interesting back and forth that Justice Alito had with the Solicitor General. There was a lot of argument about the standing issue, and I suspect that may be the focus of the court's opinion when it comes out. And I wouldn't be surprised to see this case resolve on the standing issue instead of on the substantive merits of the underlying issues.
Zach, many have accused and alleged that Merrick Garland is one of the most politicized and political and partisan attorney generals we've seen in modern history. And Zach, you wrote an article recently that may suggest that that type of systemic discrimination, we'll use a word from the left here, may be spreading throughout the federal judiciary. Zach, you got a new piece up in the Daily Signal that's very interesting, titled "Tipping the Scales of Justice to the Left, the Federal Judiciary's New Guidance for Assigning Cases." Zach, what's going on here?
Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize it, Tim, but the federal judiciary essentially has their own bureaucracy, their own administrative state that holds a lot of sway over the policies that are pushed out to federal courts across the country. There's the governing body of the federal judiciary called the Judicial Conference of the United States. And then there's also an entity known as the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts, which is supposed to just provide administrative assistance, best practices for case management, that sort of thing. Well, unfortunately, what's happened over the past several years is that these supposedly nonpartisan bodies have increasingly waded into political disagreements. We've seen a number of troubling diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives coming out of these offices. And then most recently, the Judicial Conference responded to criticisms that had been levied by Chuck Schumer, Sheldon Whitehouse, Hank Johnson, and others on the left about how cases were being assigned in certain judicial districts. And what was at the heart of these complaints by Chuck Schumer's and these other senators and representatives and others on the left is essentially they didn't like the decisions that these judges were handing out. These judges were ruling against the left's preferred positions. And so, unfortunately, they successfully lobbied the judicial conference to try to change the rules, try to make sure that those judges didn't get any more of these high-profile, hot-button cases. And sadly, the judicial conference caved to this pressure and issued what are, in my view, very problematic guidance in that regard.
Zach, I want to go international with you, my friend. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, it looks like we almost got him back here to the United States. Looks like Great Britain was going to extradite him. They wanted assurances, though, that the death penalty would be taken off of the table in order for that to happen. I don't think we've agreed to that. Give us your legal opinion on Julian Assange. Is what he does, is he a First Amendment patriot, or is he a traitor who got some of our spies and some of the people that were helping us overseas, maybe have gotten them killed or put in great harm?
Well, I see you don't want to talk about anything controversial on today's show. So I'll confess, I haven't been following the latest legal wranglings of Julian Assange particularly closely. But, you know, what's interesting about this is that it does play into the larger debate about the death penalty that's happening here in the United States. You know, obviously, there's a move away from imposing the death penalty for many crimes. In fact, there's Supreme Court precedent that essentially says only capital crimes will be punishable by death. You can no longer punish by death things like rape or even certain child sex offenses. There's a push in many states, Florida, Idaho, and others, to push back against some of that bad precedent. But interestingly, even though the court, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has increasingly said only the first-degree intentional premeditated murder of someone is sufficient for the death penalty to be imposed, they haven't addressed, they've carved out a category for what they call crimes against the state, things like espionage, certain very severe drug offenses, drug kingpin offenses, what it's known as. The court hasn't addressed those issues. And so if the death penalty were to be imposed for espionage, say, or something along those lines, I suspect it would certainly reignite a debate about whether that exception comports with the original understanding of the Eighth Amendment, or whether the entire case law surrounding the death penalty needs to be reevaluated, which in my view it does, because unfortunately, I think it's hard to square many of the court's death penalty decisions with the original understanding of our cruel and unusual punishments clause.
Zach, that was one heck of a pivot. I've got to give it to you.
I might have broken my ankle.
If I was guarding you in basketball, I would have broken my ankles, and one of my shoelaces would have been one of my shoes would have been on the other end of the court. That was a heck of a pivot there.
Mm-hmm. Zach, before we let you go, do we have a new episode of SCOTUS 101, the podcast, coming up this weekend?
Yeah, we do. We're going to talk a little bit about some of these issues at the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts and the Judicial Conference. We're obviously going to cover the abortion oral argument that took place earlier this week. And then I have a fascinating interview with Professor John Yoo. Professor Yoo is a law professor out at Berkeley. Believe it or not, he is a conservative, one of the lone conservatives teaching there. And so he gives an interesting analysis of some things to watch out for in the upcoming Trump immunity case that's going to be before the Supreme Court. And then he actually gave this year's Edwin Meese lecture, originalism lecture at the Heritage Foundation. And the topic was, can originalism be moral? And so we had a fascinating conversation about that. And so I hope everyone will tune in and take away some good information.
Zach, thank you so much for joining us this Wednesday. Have a great weekend, my friend, and we look forward to picking your legal mind next week, sir.
Thanks so much. Good talking to you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Zach.
And John, you I'm familiar with. When I went to the Old Parkland Conference in Dallas, he interviewed Justice Thomas at an event after dinner. So I am aware of who he is, and he is a rare breed of being a conservative on the campus of Berkeley.
Famous one indeed. Yes, he is.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. 4:44, Chris's Corner coming up. We'll talk about Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and some other news regarding their campaign. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
There is some polling to suggest that Trump is gaining their support. You had your fellow South Carolinian James Clyburn in January saying that Biden's message was not breaking through the MAGA wall, so to speak. Has Biden's message done anything to change that?
Well, I fundamentally believe, as in past elections, the African-American community, the black vote, will be there for Joe Biden in this election. When we look at what he has done and accomplished, this is not just words, but actually how he's delivered. He's made sure that we've had, as a community, a seat at the table. Just think about this. Personally, you know, there has been no Democratic president who's ever appointed a black person to be the chair of the DNC.
450 on the Tim Jones and Chris Harb show. Boy, he must be paid very, very well. Because if you ask average Mr. and Mrs. Black American, they don't feel that they have a seat at the table, mm-hmm. or that they've been involved, or this economy and Bidenomics is working for them. Tim, before we get into Chris's Corner, you reported some sad news during the break that former senator and vice presidential nominee candidate Joe Lieberman of Connecticut has passed away. I tried to look it up on the computer there. It just said those basic details, and that the story is developing, so we don't know why. It's amazing that you said it, because he was involved with No Labels, mm-hmm. this third-party candidate movement. I saw him on TV probably 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. Yeah. He seemed healthy,
looked
spry.
Looked and sounded good.
Young, so it's one of those things that you never know. Our condolences go out to Joe Lieberman and his family. He was one of the last Kennedy
Democrats.
There's another one, Kennedy, Truman. Style Democrats, mm-hmm. that cared about foreign policy. He was a Jewish American. He cared very, very much about Israel and national security.
Unlike Chuck Schumer, a huge defender of Israel to this day.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So our prayers go out to Senator Lieberman to his family on his death today. I think, Jim, you said he was 82 years old.
I'll miss him, Chris. He was a happy warrior in a party that's kind of gotten nasty and mean, the Democratic Party. I was first introduced to him, Chris, when I was living in New York. He was a frequent flyer on Don Imus's morning show in New York that I listened to. He was a regular, and he always struck me, you know, he had liberal tendencies, sure. and sometimes when he talked about spending more money and all that, you know, I would kind of grimace a little bit. But on the other hand, Chris, I found myself agreeing with him a lot on a lot of things, because he believed in America. He was a proud Jewish American and a staunch defender of Israel. He understood the world stage like few politicians do these days, and I thought he had his wits and his humor about him till the very end. As like you said, yeah. I just saw him as well on one of the morning shows, and I'm really sad to hear that he's passed away.
And you remember, he left the Senate. I think he was defeated in a primary, ran again as an independent. I think he won. May have lost. I'm not sure of that. But yeah, longtime senator. Our prayers go out to Senator Lieberman. Al Joy, hit it.
Chris.
And if you don't know, now you know.
And now, Chris's Corner.
You know, you heard that clip there of the paid surrogate of the Democratic Party saying that he believes that the African-American vote will be there for Joe Biden in November, because mm-hmm. all of that he has done for African-Americans. You know, there's some stories that are leaking out in the New York Times here, an African-American. She's always on MSNBC as a contributor. Her name is Nia Malika Henderson. She had a title of an article that said, Biden needs more than barbershops and churches to win black voters. Mm. And that's the traditional route that the Democratic Party goes, especially in October and in early November. Get the church vote out, go to the barbershops, and act like you care, be in the community. You know, James Carville, the Raging Cajun, he was the strategist there for Bill Clinton back in 1992. He says that President Biden is bleeding black male voters, and he says the reason for that is the message is too feminine, he says. Everything you're doing is destroying the planet. You've got to eat your peas, he says. So James Carville believes that that's one of the reasons why President Trump is getting 20-25% of the African-American total vote now, but he had 20% of the African-American male vote in 2020. Maybe that is the reason that the African-American men aren't for transgender influencers being put on beer cans or any type of things like that. Maybe, you know, African-American men are red-blooded men, just like most men are. James Comer, he is the one that is the head of the House Oversight Committee. He is looking into impeaching Joe Biden for the things that he did with the shady business dealings. He sent out a fundraising email looking like there will not be an impeachment. He said, quote, "It's clear Democrats will choose their party over their country and the truth at every turn. That's why I'm preparing criminal referrals at the culmination of my investigation," adding that the, quote, "new leadership at the DOG under Trump would prosecute the Biden crime family and deliver swift justice." So it makes you wonder there, is he wrapping this investigation up? Will there not be an impeachment? I think just from a political standpoint that they should keep this going at least throughout the spring, throughout the summer, all the way up to the election, release a report 2 weeks before the election. You know, that's something that the Democrats would do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you won't hear much about this in the news, but the drive-by media is doing a little bit of reporting on Jim Biden, President Joe Biden's brother. A lot of people have said that he is just as crooked as Jim Biden. He never did get involved in politics. Was the business aspect of it. A report in the New York Times said that feds have recently sought information about Jim Biden's business dealings in two cases. Quote, "Federal investigators in South Florida recently probed transactions leaked to Jim Biden as part of a criminal investigation, according to two people familiar with the matter. The investigation remains open."
Aha.
And then there's some other cases where there's a story here. We don't have the time to get into it, where he was meeting with a guy who was part of the Gambino crime family, but was based in Florida doing business with them. So the media tells us over and over and over, there's nothing there. This is a witch hunt. You know, no smoking gun, but it's like right there in front of them, but they just don't want to see it. That is Chris's Corner.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and yet Donald Trump mentions a Russian word, and suddenly he's colluding with the Kremlin. You know?
Exactly. 5:07, Speaker stump speech, and at 5:24, Francis House School Board candidates Adriana Kuhn and Sam Young in studio with us talking about their race. Listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.